couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, Tetris, The Big Door Prize, and a look back at Buck Rogers in the 25th century. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Dead Silence on 4K and Demo Memorial Keys. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I'm going to quickly drive by the box office here just because I think it's worth noting. John Wick Chapter 4 made $74 million over the weekend, and that's phenomenal. I think that's the highest opening a John Wick movie has ever done. And when you look at it, the first movie was like $20 million, and it made just barely over $74 million in its total run. So this is a huge step up, and they're going to keep making these John Wick movies, whether they find a way to do prequels or tell some sort of continuing story. They've already got Ballerina, which is a spinoff with Ana de Armas coming up, so they're going to be doing a whole bunch of stuff. Shazam Fury of the Gods absolutely imploded and didn't even make $10 million in its second weekend. It is doing so poorly that this Shazam movie may not even make $100 million total. I mean, we're not even at the point where Shazam Fury of the Gods has made total what its opening weekend was for the original Shazam movie. So, yeah, this is catastrophic and bad for DC in this. It's a good thing that they're rebooting the universe. And that's a shame because the Shazam properties and Black Adam, they could have some really cool stuff. But, you know, with everybody throwing everybody under the bus, they mismanaged that wholly. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, and this is was big news. Last weekend, Jonathan Majors was arrested for potential domestic violence charges. I don't know the facts. That haven't really come out yet. They're still processing the case, and so I'm not assuming guilt here or there, but there are some interesting developments to this, mainly because the lawyer says, oh, no, we've got this evidence. You got body cam footage and texts and statements that prove his innocence. And one of them is apparently they have texts from the woman that imply that it was not him attacking her. And I don't know how seriously they're going to take that, because there is a history in this country and elsewhere of domestic violence victims recanting their testimony. This is not an uncommon thing. So we have to let this all play out. Now, in the meantime, Jonathan Majors made these commercials for the U.S. Army, and they spent like $117 million on this campaign, running them through March Madness and everything. And now they've kind of paused them and they're re-editing them, because here's the thing. You do not want the face of your brand being somebody who is currently charged with domestic violence. And even more so, what does this mean for Marvel? I mean, Creed and everything. Yeah, he's got big stuff in the works, but Marvel's the big thing. And I think that there were a lot of phone calls going on at Marvel last weekend. And I would not be surprised if Marvel is launching its own investigation. That has nothing to do with the legality of it. Here's the thing. I said this with the Shazam stuff. You notice how you don't have a bunch of the Marvel actors out there stabbing each other in the back and throwing each other under the bus? And if you notice that, for the most part, the Marvel actors have kept their nose clean, that doesn't mean they're better people, but I imagine that Disney, and it probably goes back to Marvel, even when it was dealing with Paramount, I would not be surprised if there's language in their contracts that says, essentially, you are not allowed to get arrested. Even if you're innocent, just you being arrested and going through these charges, we have the option of removing you from the franchise. It can cause a problem contractually. I mean, look, my wife's a teacher, and there's morality clauses in her contract. And if she were to get arrested for any crazy charge, even if it was 100% false, that could endanger her job because of just the appearance of it. And you can put that in a contract. You can say you can't get arrested, or you have to have a certain sort of behavioral element to your thing. And this is the danger with being a Marvel actor and having that happen. All this stuff is done on a computer now. You could literally reshoot all of Kang's footage from Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, and when they roll that out on Disney Plus, you're going to have a different person playing him. Same thing with the Kang footage from Loki. You got to remember, he's not starred in a whole bunch of these movies where he's hardwired into it. They've recast before. Talk to Terrence Howard about that. But if you look at how they did Thanos in the lead up to the Endgame and Infinity War movies, Thanos just showed up a couple scenes here and there. He was not a heavily done character, and they could have always put in a different character. That's all. He was a completely CGI'd character. Now, while Jonathan Majors is appearing as himself, there's these elements you can replace people. I mean, these movies, if somebody does something wrong, it's like Joseph Stalin is directing them. You just erase them and put somebody else in there. I mean, it's very possible for Disney to drop Jonathan Majors like a hot potato. I think they're playing get close to the breast and saying, you know, let's just see what happens here. But if these charges stick, or if other things are uncovered, or even if it's nothing that's announced, if it's just Disney's like, ooh, we don't want our version of Ezra Miller tainting our franchise, they might drop him if he becomes persona non grata. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Asteroid City, which comes to theaters on June 16th.
You're not here.
We're not there. The car exploded.
Where are you?
Asteroid City, Farm Route 6, mile 75.
What do those pulses indicate?
What? Oh, the beeps and blips? We don't know.
Some of our information about outer space may no longer be completely accurate. Anyway, there's still only 9 planets in the solar system as far as we know, Billy?
Except now there's an alien.
I don't like the way that guy looked at us. The alien.
How did he look?
Like we're doomed.
Maybe we are.
I'm a big Wes Anderson fan, I will admit. I love most of his movies. His last movie, The French Dispatch, I didn't like that. It was too busy. Too much stuff was going on in that movie. So that was probably, I mean, I was never a huge fan of Bottle Rockets because he hadn't developed his style yet. And I know everyone loves Rushmore. I'm like, yeah, it was okay. My favorite of his was The Royal Tenenbaums, but I love stuff like Moonrise Kingdom and The Great Budapest Hotel. I love his work. I know that's completely quirky, but I'm okay with that. I like the quirkiness. I can lean into that. Asteroid City looks very quirky. It looks like, every time a Wes Anderson movie comes out, everyone's like, this is the most Wes Anderson-y movie of Wes Anderson I've ever seen. It's quirky, it's weird, but I think it's going to be a more self-contained story, like Moonrise Kingdom, rather than trying to juggle too many things like The French Dispatch or even Grand Budapest Hotel, which I loved, but this one's kind of going back to the well of weirdness, and I love that. So I'm wildly looking forward to it. The next one I want to talk about is Elemental, which is from Pixar, comes into theaters also on June 16th.
Meet the residents of Element City.
This shop is dream of our family.
Someday it'll all be yours.
But we all live by one simple rule.
Elements cannot mix.
So you've never left Firetown?
Sorry, buddy. Elements don't mix.
Hey!
Plus, my dad would boil you alive.
Why does anyone get to tell you what you can do in your life?
You know, I love Pixar, and I love the fact that Pixar takes these relatively simple concepts of growth and development in life and makes them completely abstract. This one is not terribly well-veiled. I mean, something like Inside Out really got into this nuance of teenage emotion, which I really appreciated. Elemental right now, it looks like it's very basic. People can date other people kind of thing. And it's okay to have that. And considering all the stuff that's going on in the culture wars right now, it's nice to have something uplifting and saying, hey, you have the freedom to do what you want to do. So this looks like it's going to be cute. I'm looking forward to it. So yeah, a new Pixar movie this summer. Yeah, count me in. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the Big Door Prize and Buck Rogers in the 25th century.
Pump up the champ.
This is a public service announcement. Manscaped now has beard products, and it's going even further with their brand new Weed Whacker 2.0. Go ahead and tell the world the leaders in below-the-line waist grooming are traveling north of your South Pole with their revolutionary grooming products. The new Weed Whacker 2.0 and their new beard line confirms that they have the best tools for your hygiene toolbox. Time for you to upgrade your game by going to manscaped.com and using our code FATGUYS for 20% off and free shipping. There's a lot of good stuff in here. You've got a beard trimmer with 20 different hair cutting lengths. You've got beard shampoo and conditioner and beard oil and beard balm all in this Beard Hedger Pro Kit. It gives you everything you need to trim everything nice. And then on top of it, you get all the little small parts, the nose hairs and the ears hair. Let's face it, hair is a great thing to have, but hair in some places is not. So check out the brand new Weed Whacker 2.0 with improved blades and skin-safe technology. Get 20% off and free shipping with our code FATGUYS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And use our code FATGUYS. Always use the right tool for the right job with Manscaped. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews and talk about the Big Door Prize. This is on Apple TV. It dropped on Wednesday, so you have, I think, 3 episodes out right now. A new fortune-telling game in a general store upends stability in a small town.
That thing will tell you your life's potential.
Where'd you get it?
No idea. It just appeared like magic.
You know what I got? Superstar.
Well, I got dancer.
Male model.
Make it stop.
What's going on? Why is everybody trying to change their lives overnight?
We're getting a divorce.
The Morpho inspired us.
What was your card?
Healer. Assigned to engage in self-healing.
Or maybe it meant doctor, as in the profession that you do every day.
I've only watched the first 3 episodes of this, and it's interesting. It stars Chris O'Dowd, and I've loved Chris O'Dowd ever since the IT Crowd. But the choices he's made after something like that, his stuff's very dark. I've watched a couple shows and movies that he's been in, and he's usually like, he picks some darker stuff. And there's a dark tinge to the Big Door Prize. It's very open speculatively and sort of like a video game console in this store, and gives you a card and it tells you what your potential is. Like, you might go in and say rock musician or something like that, or magician. So it has this sort of Twilight Zone setup. The thing that worries me about it is that's the stuff I find intriguing, the mystery behind what this is, and then the effect that it has on the small town. And that's something, the reason I talk about Twilight Zone specifically is because Twilight Zone dealt with a lot of small town stuff. I mean, Rod Serling was from a small town, and he often dealt with how these small Americana, middle of nowhere type places reacted to different things. I mean, the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street is a perfect example of how a small town were to turn on itself. And there's several episodes of Twilight Zone that do that. And that's a microcosm of larger cities and entire governments. But there's a beauty to that and a simplicity to that allegory nature. And that seems to be what they're doing here. My worry is that when we eventually get to the payoff, there's going to be no fantastic element to it at all. I have a feeling it's going to be underwhelming. And that worries me, because then you're just using that as a hook to get people in, and then you pull the mask off the Scooby-Doo villain at the end, and you're like, no, there was nothing mystical or fascinating about this, or otherworldly, or beyond everyday mundane stuff. So seeing the reaction of a small town, I think, is good. I think the characters are well constructed. I think people's reaction and sort of the mass hysteria element of the series works, but I have a feeling it's going to just lead you on with the mystical side of it, the more fantastic side. And I think you could do both. I like shows that can do both. Severance is a great example of something on Apple TV that has this science fiction element that's hardwired in there, but it does examine human nature. And I think there's a laziness to writing if you examine human nature with a sci-fi or a speculative element and then abandon it because you're like, oh, I don't deal with fantasy. So I just have a feeling that that's what's going to happen in this show. It's interesting, but it's also turning into something more about itself and enjoying the gossipy nature of a small town rather than leaning a bit more into the speculative elements. So still, I mean, it's a realistic look in the lives of a small town in America, but it holds back too much on the more mysterious elements. I want something more there, and I hope that it delivers. I'll probably continue to watch a couple episodes, but if they never get to it, because that's what happened with one of the alien invasion shows they had. I think it was Invasion. It was called on Apple TV Plus. I felt that one skimped on the speculative. They never got to it, but it has promise. So I'm going to say that the Big Door Prize so far kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Buck Rogers in the 25th century. An astronaut from 1987 is frozen in a mission and returns to Earth 500 years later.
Where am I?
You were aboard the King's flagship Draconia, under command of the Royal Princess Ardala, on its way to Earth on a peace mission.
This is quite a setup.
It's Colonel Daring, commander of Earth's defenses. Take this barbarian in for interrogation.
Captain Buck Rogers, you are now in the 25th century.
Watch out, Major, on your tail!
Captain Rogers, I ordered you to stay out of this.
Colonel, you need all the help you can get.
Now, the history of Buck Rogers has started out as a comic strip, like almost 100 years ago, or just about, actually maybe less than 100 years ago. And they've made several versions of it. They did a serial back in the 30s. You can actually get that on Tubi. That serial is on there. And there's like radio programs. And because Star Wars made huge business in the box office, and then they did Battlestar Galactica, and the same people who did Battlestar Galactica, Glenn A. Larson, decided to do this Buck Rogers show. And they made a 2-hour premiere event, and they put that in theaters. And then, of course, that launched the series. And I remember seeing that as a kid. It came out in 1979, and I enjoyed it. They added some new stuff, like they added the character of Tweaky, which is this little robot, because obviously Star Wars is trying to play off of that. And it's voiced by Mel Blanc, so it's like, beady, 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 what's up, Buck? And there's some real fascinating stuff in this version of it. First of all, the Dr. Theopolis character, which is this computer brain that Tweaky walks around with, and he's the ambiquad for it. I love the character of Dr. Theopolis. I love the idea that this futuristic society is run by these computers, and the computers, basically, that's the board who runs the whole society, and they answer to them. So I think it's a real interesting look at, you know, the use of artificial intelligence, kind of like before that became a thing. I like the fact Wilma Deering, who's played by Erin Gray, I do like the outfits she wears because they're all skin tight and you see a lot of leg and her caboose. Actually, everybody in this series, by the way, has a great butt. Gil Gerard is Buck Rogers. He's got a nice tush as well, as does Hawk in the second season. I'll get to him in a second. But Wilma Deering, played by Erin Gray, who's always wearing these skin-tight clothes, she's very aggressive. She's the colonel, and yeah, there's a little bit of a romance going on, but it's a pretty strong female character, and they keep that through most of the first season, pretty much, and I think that that's great. It certainly gets silly, and it does have that Glenn Larson Battlestar Galactica feel, and they used a lot of the same sets and designs and stuff. So, I mean, it's certainly made on a budget. Now, when they did the second season, they had a writer's strike in the middle, and they got new showrunners, and the second season's trying to be a little more Star Trek. It's about them trying to find the lost tribes of Earth, and they always end up going onto a planet, but they have a very Star Trek feel. You can tell that the showrunner had a history of doing Westerns, but there's still some neat stuff. Hawk is this character that shows up in the second season. He's a fantastic character. I mean, he's a goofy written character, but Tom Christopher as Hawk so commits to it and is so serious about it. He's made me fall in love with the character. It's just his portrayal, because he's like, you know what? This is a silly character, a guy with feathers on his head who's a part bird, but I'm going to play it as straight as possible, and boy, that really works. But it does not quite reach the level of the original Star Trek. The first season aims for Star Wars and the second season for Star Trek, and they miss the mark both times, but it still offers a fun space adventure for television. I'm going to say that Buck Rogers in the 25th century totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, and Tetris. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the big one in theaters this week, and that is Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves. A band of misfits try to steal an artifact and clear their names in the kingdom.
We help the wrong person steal the wrong thing. We didn't mean to unleash the greatest evil the world has ever known. But we're gonna fix it.
So how do we pull that off?
You need cooling!
To give us a fighting chance, we're gonna need strength. You got this, right?
I know you don't.
We also need courage. Back to school. Magic. And you.
I remember when Dungeons & Dragons first became a thing as a role-playing game. I was in school. It was like right around 1980. I don't remember exactly when it was. I actually have somewhere. I have one of the original modules. I have the original books. There were like two or three books that were before they really started publishing them all over the place. And I have the original ones. They're buried in my attic somewhere. But I remember going through that, and I played it a couple times. I never got heavily into role-playing games. I don't think I just had the time commitment for it. And my closest friends weren't as into it as some of my other friends. But I played Dungeons & Dragons a couple times, and, you know, over the 80s, and I think maybe once or twice in the 90s. So I understand how the game works. And I've had a lot of people ask me, is it a video game or is it a role-playing game? I go, started out as a role-playing game. And here's why that lends itself to a movie better. In a video game, they're always notoriously difficult to make into a successful film because the way video games are constructed, there's more of a backstory. And then your goal is to just kind of get through the world. You know, either it's a shooting game or it's a puzzle game, but the plot's less relevant to the gameplay. It's more of a backdrop. Whereas Dungeons & Dragons as a role-playing game essentially sets up a world. And then you can have all these different stories within the world. Anybody can do whatever they want to, and you can create your own little self-contained story. And then that becomes important with the story and the characters because everybody builds their own character. And so that allows these individual stories to take place in this world. Now, they tried doing a Dungeons & Dragons movie a couple of years ago, like 20, and it was terrible. And then they did, I think they did a sequel, and it was also terrible. They did a cartoon back in the 80s, which I really enjoyed as a kid. I thought that was a pretty innovative cartoon because it basically took real people and they got trapped into the Dungeons & Dragons world. This one's just about the characters of the world, and it has a spectacle. I mean, you got good cast. You got Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez, and Hugh Grant is in there, and it takes place within the world, but it's not that heavy, dark, almost exhausting high fantasy you get with either the Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones properties. Those take themselves so seriously. And this one's a little more whimsical. This one feels like the characters are a bunch of people just playing in a game. They're the people getting together at the end of the week, and they're like kind of blowing off steam, and some of them are having fun. There are some people who don't take it fully seriously, which is kind of Chris Pine's bit. And then there are some people who take it overly seriously. You know, if anyone is out there who's gamed and done sort of the role-playing games, anything from Dungeons & Dragons to LARPing out in the woods, there's always that one person who insists on talking in a British accent through the entire game and like won't break character. Those people are also represented in this movie. And I think that that's fun because you get all different types and it fits in the world. And it's got the spectacle, Dungeons and Dragons and magic and fighting and sorcery. And you've got all the special effects. It's an effective film. There's some problems with it. I think that the beginning rushes the story. It's real clunky. That first half hour is very clunky. They're trying to put in backstory. And one of the problems when you're trying to put too much backstory into something is you run the risk of the person saying, why am I watching this movie? That looks like a more interesting movie. Why don't you make that movie? And so they threaten to do that at the beginning. They cram a lot of stuff at you. And then there's some bad cinematography choices, which is trendy now. You know, everything shot in shadow, or they shoot everything with a light background behind it. And then they don't like the actual key actors, which, like I said, that's trending in real now, but it's impossible to see, especially if the theaters you go to tend to have bad projection or they don't run their bulbs at full brightness, which is kind of everywhere now. So it's not a perfect movie, but it works. It's fun. It's a nice little lark. It's about 2 hours, so it's not, you know, it's not this 3-hour monstrosity of a epic fantasy. I had a lot of fun. I mean, it's told with the whimsy of a group role-playing on the weekend, and it delivers decent spectacle and characters. I'm going to say Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Tetris. The mostly true story follows a developer traveling to Russia in 1988 to secure the rights to a groundbreaking video game.
It's a combination of Tetra, Greek for four, and tennis.
Tennis.
The Russian inventor, he likes tennis.
This game isn't just addictive. It stays with you. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Hank, only 10 other people in the world have seen what you're about to see. It's called the Game Boy.
Package it with Tetris. Can you get us the rights? I'm gonna go to Moscow.
You're walking into a country
that still considers America enemy numero uno.
Okie dokie.
I first encountered Tetris as an arcade game at a movie theater with a friend of mine, and it would have been right around 1989. So it fits right when it came out. And like most people, I was fascinated with it. And I remember when I ended up getting a Nintendo NES, I was like, I need to make sure it has Tetris, and it was packaged with it. I loved Tetris. And it was funny, after I watched this movie, I downloaded Tetris on my phone and was playing it a little bit. Because it is this perfect video game. And they've added some elements to it, and they've kind of brushed it up and gussied it up a little bit. But the essence of it, the classic Tetris, still exists. But I never knew the story behind it. And I'll admit that the story in this movie, not everything that happens in the movie happened in real life. It Hollywoodizes a good chunk of stuff, especially stuff near the end, and sort of like there's these almost spy type elements that they add in there, because I mean the story's about a guy who just goes to Russia in the 80s, and he does it on like a tourist visa, which is highly illegal. He could have been put in a gulag for that, but he's there trying to broker a deal for the rights to this thing. Because since it's behind the Iron Curtain, there was no like really open exchange of information. It was very difficult for anybody in Russia to sell intellectual property rights. And there's a certain amount of business politics that's going on behind the scenes that I also found fascinating, that they were able to incorporate in the movie without getting too far into the weeds. Because when it comes to legal rights and contracts and licenses, the average viewer is going to zone out quickly, but I think they set that out there in nice little chunks, makes it easy to understand. And it also is a neat look at what Russia was like in the 80s. People forget now. I mean, I grew up with that, but I don't even know if that was real growing up as a kid. That could have been just propaganda from the West Side about what Russia was really like, but I have a feeling this is pretty accurate on what it was like to live in Russia under the thumb of communism and the Socialist Soviet Union. So this is a neat story. It's not a totally unique story. I mean, there's certain parts of it that are fascinating, but there's a whole breed of story of the guy who's an innovator in business, and he has an idea, and he's kind of like betting the farm on everything for this one product or something. There's another one of these type of movies coming up in the next week or two. And it's just about that zealot trying to make it all work. And the danger in a movie like this is if you're that person, you may be betting the farm on a loser idea. I mean, what if Tetris never took off? This guy would have lost everything, but it doesn't, you know, because we know what Tetris is now. It's a neat little movie. I enjoyed it. I was surprised at how efficiently it moved. It's an excellent mix of 8-bit nostalgia, 80s pop culture, and reality with a healthy dose of Hollywood liberties. I'm going to say that Tetris as a movie on Apple TV Plus totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I've got the Home Cinema Roundup featuring two pieces, Dead Silence in 4K and Demo Memorial Keys. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We're going to move into the Home Cinema Roundup here in a minute. And part of the thing is, I sometimes get discs and things to review. Now, I requested Dead Silence, which I'm going to be talking about here. And that's from Shout Factory. Shout Factory, I've sung their praises before. They do a great job curating these classic titles. And some of them, you know, I don't know if I'd call Dead Silence a classic. I mean, it's certainly, you know, it's like 15 years old. I'm talking about like some of the titles that they curate. They have stuff from the 80s and the 90s and even the 60s and 70s. So they've got a lot of what would be considered cult or out of print pieces, things that the studios nowadays, they don't want to repackage. Shout Factory does a lot of good stuff. So when I requested a screener of Dead Silence, they also sent me a screener of this Demo Memorial Keys, which I was unfamiliar with, but because it was sent there and it was something new and something different, I thought I'd include both of them. So that sound means it's time to roll into the Home Cinema Roundup. The first one I want to talk about is Dead Silence, which is coming out on a new 4K. It's packaged with a Blu-ray as well. James Wan directs this thriller about a grieving widower searching for the origin of the haunted ventriloquist dummy that killed his wife.
There's an old ghost story around here about a woman named Mary Shaw.
The ventriloquist who lost her voice. Back when I was a boy, a little boy went missing.
There was only ever one suspect. Mary Shaw.
She was murdered.
The men cut out her tongue.
And this town has been plagued by death ever since.
She was buried with her doll collection.
The children, as she called them.
Okay, I know that blurb sounds stupid. It sounds almost laughable. But I think as a premise, it works. I mean, look, anything with dummies or dolls can have a great, scary look to them. This doll looks almost too much like the doll from the Goosebumps movies, which came afterwards, by the way. But I think the book preceded this. It looks like a very basic Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy type ventriloquist dummy. And I love James Wan. I'm a huge James Wan fan. I've met the guy. I love his energy. The guy loves films and he loves making films. And this came after Saw and Saw 2, I think, although he didn't direct Saw 2. But James Wan at that time was still sort of finding his style. And eventually when he was doing movies like Insidious and The Conjuring, he really galvanized his style and approach. At least from horror. I mean, he's done action stuff, too. He did one of the Fast and Furious movies, and did Aquaman. But, I mean, his roots are in horror. And Dead Silence is him still working in the horror genre and figuring out what his style was. And I think the story is cool, and there's some great stuff in this movie. There's some incredible scenes. There's some incredible cinematography. There's setups, and you can see where elements from The Conjuring and Insidious and even Malignant, which is a great film that went kind of nowhere, you can see where the genesis of some of his cinematic language comes from. The problem with this movie is the writing. The character, the main character, is just awful. He's very generic, early 2000s, early 20s lead. You know, he looks like he stepped off of the set of Dawson's Creek and is now trying to spin off a career from that. That's what kind of holds this movie back. When he started casting outside of that trope, I think is when things got much better. But this character, he's just boring. And they've got Donnie Wahlberg, of all people, playing the detective who's following him around. And Donnie Wahlberg also comes from the Saw franchise. So it does fall into all those tropes of sort of early 2000s, you know, mid-aught decade where it blusters a bit too much. And it feels there's some things that feel cheap, like some of the graphics and some of the effects feel cheap. Once you get away from that, if you can separate the terrible character from the movie itself, there's some really great stuff in there. And there's some real creepy stuff, and it's got some great reveals, and there's some great twists and turns in it. So it's worth seeing. I think it's held up better than it did when I first saw it, because I did not like it in theaters. I had to go see it because they didn't screen it. But if James Wan were to make this today, it would be a very different movie, and it'd be much better. And it's sort of shackled by, I think, what the studio wanted him to put in, maybe not what he necessarily wanted to put in. So, I mean, the dreadfully boring lead drags the film down, but it still serves as an intriguing look at James Wan developing his style. So the 4K image looks great. And what's interesting is I was watching with my kids at their place, and something was going wrong with their 4K player. And so I put in the Blu-ray disc, and it was really interesting to go from 4K to Blu-ray, and you really see a quality difference. I mean, the prints cleaned up for 4K, it looks pristine. I mean, I will say it was a noticeable difference when we had to change the discs, which is great. Now, the Blu-ray has all the special features. There's some new stuff. There's a couple behind-the-scenes stuff, interviews with James Wan and Lee Whannell, who helped write it, I believe, and the guy who created the dummy. And they've got the unrated version of the film. They've got an alternate opening and ending and some deleted scenes. And then, of course, some vintage featurettes. I actually am going to recommend it. I'm going to call it a kind of rocks at this point because of where it fits in the history of James Wan's films. But it still has its problems as a movie.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next one I want to talk about is Demo, Memorial Keys. This is also a disc that came. Based on the popular Japanese game, this fantasy tells the story of a girl who is trapped in a mysterious world with toy figurines and a dark creature that plays the piano.
There are so many complexities in this song. If only we had the title to give us a clue. Something like Spring Melody.
Cherry blossoms. Looks like they're starting to bloom.
Cherry blossoms. Hey, do you think I'd be able to go home once this tree grows taller?
Now, apparently this is based on a game. I've never played this game. It's a musical game where supposedly you're supposed to press the keys, and it's a much more elegant version of Guitar Hero, I guess. I think I've probably insulted anybody who likes that game because they'd be like, Guitar Hero is so basic. Anyways, it's a CGI anime style. So it's not quite anime. It's when you say Crunchyroll anime, that's what you think. It's not exactly that, but it has that Japanese style of animation to it. I don't know if it's completely done in the computer. I think it is. You know, it sort of has a 2D look with some 3D elements to it. And it's a sweet story. It diverts from what you would normally expect from a piece of Japanese animation. It aims for a lower, younger audience. I don't think it's as much for adults. I don't know, because I culturally I'm not plugged into this. But the story's relatively simple. You know, this girl gets trapped, and it has this real creepy looking Slender Man type creature, but that plays a piano, and the music is woven into the story. And there's also this outside of the world where she's trapped. There are these girls who are in a school, and there's one girl who plays the piano, and they're trying to kind of identify the song and figure out how the song relates to her life. It ties it in with the characters in this sort of mysterious world underneath. And the more they play this piano, this tree grows, and that sort of is a connection between worlds. But there's a whole story behind this, and I don't know if this follows exactly what's in the game. Because I think the gameplay seems to be emerging from the film. I don't know if the overall story behind it is the same. So It has some neat stuff in it. It has some beautiful imagery, and it has some really nice animation once you get past the CGI overbearing element to it. You know, it's innovative and inspiring, but it is stylistically imperfect. But it offers a gentler version of animation from Japan. I mean, it doesn't have the overall violence and dread, and as well, it doesn't have the vision and the scope of some animation, but it's a little easier to digest. And it feels like it's a story that's more of a fairy tale for younger viewers than for adults necessarily. It's something that I can relate to, but only a little bit. I think that I'm missing a lot culturally with it. But still, it's worth checking out if you want to see it. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Super Mario Brothers and Air. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.